Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and there seems to be a conservative push right now to reclaim Calvin Coolidge from the dustbin of history and revise his legacy from failed president who set us up for the Depression with his laissez-faire policies to something better than that as the U.S. debates bank regulation and government's role in the economy again today. The conservative economics writer Amity Schles published one such book recently. With us now is the author of the other, just out, Why Coolidge Matters, Leadership Lessons from America's Most Underrated President, out from the rightward-leaning Encounter Books. The author, Charles Johnson, is with us. Charles, welcome to WNYC. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And why now? This isn't just about history, I'm guessing, but about the politics of today, that there's a Coolidge revisionism or revival taking place. Do you agree?
Well, I think what the right really needs is ideas. And Coolidge is, of course, the last president to write his own speeches. So he, you know, he wrote three collections of speeches. He won 18 out of 19 races. He was popular. He was effective. Republicans have to go back maybe 80 years to actually find somebody who is effective, which is maybe a commentary on how things are. But this is part of the reason he's coming back.
Wait, Reagan?
Well, Reagan, of course, studied Coolidge and was a huge Coolidge fan. So Coolidge was on his bookshelf, so to speak. So,
did Reagan talk about Coolidge? Were there particular things about Coolidge that Reagan articulated that influenced him?
Yes. When the PATCO strike, of course, the air traffic controller strike, is very similar to the 1919 Boston police strike, which Coolidge called in the National Guard for. Reagan took down the portrait of Harry Truman that had been in the Oval Office and put up Coolidge's. He wrote about Coolidge in letters. He had a book conference about Coolidge at the White House. When he was recovering from surgery, he was reading a biography about Coolidge. So he was very interested in him, and he grew up listening to – we know that he grew up listening to Coolidge on the radio because Coolidge is, of course, the first president to make use of radio. And this is part of the reason, you know, I think that conservatives are looking to him now. It's helpful to know what Reagan understood.
In office 1923 to early 1929 – took over when, check my history, Warren Harding died in office.
Yes.
And then he was elected on his own in 24.
Correct.
So most underrated president to your book title. How come?
Well, part of it is Coolidge was classically educated. He grew up in Plymouth Notch, Vermont. He understood small town life. He understood how to preserve the republic. He was interested in questions of race and immigration, issues that, of course, interesting to Republicans today. And he was popular among immigrant groups. So he's – the reason I think Coolidge is underrated is I think that the New Deal historians, you know, there's a tendency to sort of make a lot about FDR, and therefore because we're making a lot about FDR, we are therefore, you know, going to downplay Coolidge or downplay some of the others who came before him. And Al Smith, of course, you know, famous Democratic governor of this state, was a Coolidge fan. He got many Democrats to cross lines.
Didn't he contribute greatly to the coming stock market crash of 1929 and the Great Depression by presiding over the bubble of the 1920s, allowing the go-go credit finance economy to spiral out of control, sound familiar, and the banks to go unregulated when some of these dangers were there to be seen? And wouldn't that be a lesson not learned by Clinton and Bush?
Well, I think, there are many ways in which the 1990s are very similar to the and the early 2000s are very similar to the 1920s. But I think if we're going to actually go back and look at this period, what we have to do is actually look at Coolidge's post-presidential column. I mean, he wrote a column syndicated internationally, and in it he actually criticizes Herbert Hoover, who of course succeeds him in the White House, for socialistic notions of government. I mean, it's like a Republican criticizing another Republican. So should he get the blame for it? I think it's complicated. I think if you look at how the Harding Coolidge ticket responded to the downturn in the economy in 1920, I think there could be a case to be made that they thought it was just another downturn like the 1921. The country would roar back if the proper prudential things were done. And I'm of the school, as I know Andy Schles is, of that the 29 crash was prolonged in some sense by foolish government policy of both the right and the left.
Is it a coincidence that your book and Amity Schles' book, kind of recovering Coolidge's legacy, came out at the same time? Did you know she was writing a book? I'm sure it was not a coordinated effort, but does it reflect something parallel that's going on in conservative intellectual circles?
Well, I think what's, Amity, who's a friend, and I was an intern for her husband for all of 3 weeks at the dearly departed New York Sun. And Amity is more of the libertarian, laissez-faire school. I am more of the constitutional conservative school, by which I mean limited government is not necessarily small government. I mean, to defend Coolidge, I think you actually have to talk about the 1924 Immigration Act, which to this day is controversial. I try to do that in my book. I think you have to talk about the tariff, which, of course, a lot of libertarians don't want to talk about. And I think that's an important part. So I would put this as, there are a healthy movement is one where there are disagreements about a lot of things. And so we have our disagreements. We agree on part. And I hope both books do well. It's like McDonald's opening next to Burger King.
What was the 1924 Immigration Act?
So the 1924 Immigration Act was a restrictionist measure that was very popular, bipartisan support. And what it did was it effectively curtailed the number of immigrants coming to the United States.
It basically ended the Ellis Island era, right?
More or less, yeah. And the reason it's controversial is what it did was it set policy that harmed Eastern European and Southern European immigrants. And of course, many of them were Jews, which is, of course, an issue.
Italians
and others. And what's important to go back and look at this period is that Coolidge is arguing against eugenics at the same time that he's signing this bill. And there are many people, both the right and the left, who were arguing we need to IQ test people, that this is a racist thing. Coolidge argued strenuously against that kind of bigotry, and he wanted there to be more Japanese Americans. He thought that the quota was too small for them. And at the same time this is going on, Coolidge later signs an act that makes all Native American citizens, and he was supporting civil rights at home for blacks. He's the first president to talk about he's either the first or the second to talk about a federal anti-lynching law. So he's a complicated figure, and we have to actually go back into the historical record.
We also looked up some other Coolidge quotes to see what else was out there on this question of race, because people very rarely go back and talk about that early era of the U.S. civil rights movement and what President Coolidge's place in it might be. We found this attributed to Coolidge from Good Housekeeping magazine in 1921. There are racial considerations too grave to be brushed aside for any sentimental reasons. Biological laws tell us that certain divergent people will not mix or blend. The Nordics propagate themselves successfully. With other races, the outcome shows deterioration on both sides. Quality of mind and body suggests that observance of ethnic law is as great a necessity to a nation as immigration law. Calvin Coolidge, I guess, as vice president in 1921.
Yeah, I've looked for this quote. I've gone every single place I could to find the original copy. I cannot find it. I've gone everywhere. And what's interesting to me is that this totally contradicts the rest of Coolidge. I mean, he had as we would joke now, but he had black friends actually when having black friends actually mattered. He criticized people who would say this guy's a colored gentleman. He said, no, he's a gentleman. The reason he didn't sign the federal anti-lynching law is because lynchings plummeted because of the Coolidge prosperity and blacks got jobs. He calls the Jewish faith the faith of liberty. So that quote, I think there are a lot of quotes that are misattributed to Coolidge. Most things that most Americans know about Coolidge, as I wrote a while back, are not true. And so we have to actually go back and actually investigate him more and less of a caricature.
We're almost out of time. You make the case that America today would be pretty familiar to Coolidge. Why?
Well, in some respects. I mean, we're dealing, at least on the right, we're dealing with this question of how do we appeal to new immigrants? How do we deal with economic downturns? How do we deal with these questions of public sector unions? And Coolidge, I think it's important to understand, thought a lot about these questions. And he was very popular among Democrats. And Republicans, I think, need to do a better job of going out and talking to people who don't necessarily agree with them. And Coolidge was a master at that.
And I gather you're now working on a political biography of Barack Obama. Liberals in the audience are already cringing. Will you frame him as an anti-Coolidge in any way?
No. I mean, I think I've gone to Indonesia. I've gone to Hawaii. I've gone to Chicago and Harvard Law. And I'm fascinated with Barack Obama. I admire him tremendously, even though I don't agree with him. And I think the story about Barack Obama has not really been told to my satisfaction. I'm not going to write a hit piece or any of that sort of thing. I've been interviewing a lot of blacks who knew Obama in the South Side. So I'm trying to get the real Barack Obama. He's really fascinating. He's a very interesting character. And you don't want to caricaturize him, of course. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to actually, you know, understand Barack Obama as he understood himself. And I think that's something that the right, which has created all these boogeymen about Barack Obama, should really actually start to do serious legwork and do real journalism.
And do you think there are important parts of that story that haven't been told? There's been so much biographical writing about him, including his own two books about himself.
Sure. But as we know from the David Moranis book, parts of that are not exactly – I mean, he's – Obama thought of himself as a literature type. He did not think of himself necessarily as a reporting type. And so there are things in it that are not exactly totally accurate, shall we say. And I believe that the first book, at least, was to make him sellable in Chicago. It's a lot about race, which, of course, he has a complicated history with. And I'm interested in the real Barack Obama. I want to know people who knew him back in his college days. I'm not interested in how much drugs he did or any of that sort of stuff. I want to know what's on his bookshelf. He liked to read Robert Moses, Robert Caro's book. I'm reading that right now because I want to get the real Barack Obama.
All right. And the new book is called Why Coolidge Matters: Leadership Lessons from America's Most Underrated President. The author, Charles Johnson. You're invited back when your Barack Obama book comes out.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, happy 7th birthday, Twitter. We will give a shout out to our 20,000th Twitter follower who just followed us last weekend and invite you to make Follow Friday suggestions. You know how Twitter has Follow Friday? Well, we're going to bring it onto the radio right now. If you want to suggest someone that Brian Lehrer Show listeners might enjoy following on Twitter, call up right now, 212-433-WNYC. This is how we're going to celebrate Twitter's 7th birthday, 212-433-9692. We'll take your calls right after this.